This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The first season of HBO's White Lotus chronicled the visit to a Hawaiian resort of a select group of the very, very privileged, a tech mogul and her family, a pair of newlyweds having second thoughts, and an heiress who's grieving and in need of therapy.
When I saw my mother's ashes hit the water, you know, I just reminded me of, sprinkling fish food in an aquarium. And I was just like, oh my God, am I feeding my mother to the fishes?
All the while, the resort's manager is having a complete meltdown that's both hilarious and kind of harrowing to watch. New Yorker staff writer Nomi Fry called the show a near-note-perfect tragicomedy.
When I first watched the first season of White Lotus, I was really interested in its combination of scathing critique and kind of just basic plot enjoyment, right? So it was about watching a bunch of rich people in a luxury resort supposed to be having the time of their lives and through a series of events having like the worst time of their life, pretty much. But it also said something bigger about where we are right now as a society. And I think it's fairly rare that a show manages to do both of these things without being too ponderous or too flimsy. I think one of the things that interested me to talk about with Mike White, he's a very successful writer and creator. He wrote movies like School of Rock. He's a very well-respected and successful screenwriter and producer. But another funny and interesting thing about him that maybe some people don't know is that he's also a huge fan of reality competition shows and has even participated in a couple of those shows himself. He was on Survivor on the David versus Goliath season a few years ago. And he was also on The Amazing Race, where he partnered up with his father. And the issues that come up in those reality shows that have to do with status, competition, power relationships between people are also, I think, evident in White Lotus and what he does in White Lotus.
Season 2 of the show has just premiered, set this time in Sicily. Nomi Fry sat down with the creator, Mike White.
Was it your hope from the get-go that this would be part of a kind of series? Like, okay, each season will concentrate on another location and the connecting thread would be that these are all part of this, like, franchise, hotel franchise.
I mean,
basically.
To be honest, the first one was just such a one-off flyer, there was no big design to what would be, what would follow. In my mind, I'd always tried to figure out how to do this. Like, I was on The Amazing Race, and it was like, I was on The Amazing Race, I was like, how can I...
With your father, right?
Exactly.
Your father was your partner.
And so I was always like, this is so cool. I would love to be able to simulate this in my own, wheelhouse of scripted stuff and figure out how to travel and go new places and have, a kind of life adventure while I was still trying to make something, artistic. Like, I had this idea for a honeymoon show, which was like basically me getting to have this Amazing Race experience where, you know, it's like a couple on an ambitious honeymoon and you follow them and one of them realizes that, you know, they know the person in a way that they didn't know prior to traveling. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but then in the back of my mind, I was like, well, maybe we could do this again, new characters. So, like, the misbehaving actors from the first season that I don't want to bring back, I can just dump. Not that there were any, but, like, it's just that idea, like, I can start fresh. I'm not somebody who, like, is really that interested in, you know, keeping a franchise going creatively.
Right.
Sometimes it just feels like I don't want to, like, because after a while, that just feels like a job.
Yes.
So, like, it's like, I don't want a job. So, so this felt like great. Like, I can bring in new people, tell a new story, go somewhere new. And I mean, to me, that's like cracking the code for just my own personal, like, druthers.
Because you like to travel?
Well, it's just, I mean, like, thing? Yeah, like the experience we had in Sicily, just like, I mean, like, that's, I mean, I could start crying. Like, it's just like, just to be able to, yeah, like, I mean, that's the life I always, you know, always wanted as, like, a middle-class kid growing up in, like, a homogenous Pasadena. It was just, like, go and shoot in Asia. Go shoot in, you know, Europe. Yeah. You're like, get out of, like, my little, yeah. And now I'm spoiled. So it's, like, I think it's, like, unless it's, like, firing on all of these, like, lifestyle pistons, it's just... It's not enough. I'm just like, forget it. So, yeah, I never want to, like, drive on the 405 to, like, a stage in Burbank again.
Right.
I sound like such a douche.
That's interesting because, in a way, that kind of parallels the experiences of at least some of the people who are, you know, some of the characters on the show, right?
Yeah.
The idea of being able to leave your life behind and go and, you know, become this new thing is something that the show is kind of about in a way, right? Like, this does that
yeah,
idea
and I also
interest
think
you?
That, like, traveling, especially vacationing, it's very ripe with just the existential experience, which is like, who am I? What do I want? Like, what do I want? And like in a vacation too, it's like you're seeking pleasure. You're seeking some kind of, I don't know. It sounds, I always feel stupid talking about, but like, I do like existential, like, comedies or what. It's like that people who mm-hmm. are like searching for meaning in their life and like what is the life I want to live, and not so much situational stuff. So I just felt like I was like, this definitely feels like it's of a piece of the kinds of things I like to get into in, you know, when I write.
Screenwriter and director Mike White talking with Nomi Fry. We'll continue in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Did you write, I know that you wrote the first season on your own, which is not completely typical, I think, right? Is this, did the second season, did you write it on your own? Did you have a writer's room or?
No, I used to have a writer's room when I first started making shows. I only made four shows, but the first two had writer's rooms.
I
found it to be very, you know, the writers would write their scripts and I would look at it and I'd be like, this isn't written by by me. Like, I just, it was like, it wasn't alive unless I was immersed in it somehow. It's the part of the job that I, you know, is, I don't want to subcontract it out. You know, it's like, I don't really, yeah, it's just like, I don't see myself as a producer. I look at myself as a writer who is finding different ways to do it. And so, yeah, so I, for me, it was like, over time, I realized like, yeah, it may limit the show's point of view. It may, you know, there's criticism that comes, I guess, especially lately, of someone being the sole like kind of creator. But if I wasn't able to do that, I would just go write something, and I'd go write a book, or I'd find some other medium, because I don't want to like interpret someone else's writing. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's just not what I'm about.
Right. Although that's interesting, because I know you to also be a very successful writer for hire, right, on other people's projects.
Yeah, which is the writing part. But like, I've never really directed somebody else's work, or I mean, I've produced, but I hated it. It's just like I like kind of being helpful in those situations. Plus, it's nice to get paid.
So let's talk a little bit about this season. It seems that the focus, the thematic focus, it's more about kind of sexual politics and the ways people interact with each other and have conflict with each other and have conflict resolution with each other and so on, is through the sexual realm.
Yes. The first season, you know, was a lot about money and how it impacts all relationships. And because we shot in Hawaii, it did, you know, obviously get into colonialism and like, you know, different kind of macro elements of that same idea. And I was worried about like trafficking in that again, because I was like, I'm just going to get dragged. Like, I was already like, it was just like, I felt like we got through the first season just like by the skin of our teeth. Like, just because it was just like, you know, I don't know. Like, yeah, just and there were like, you know, fierce criticisms from certain people about me as a creator touching on these topics and as a white
man and so on.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know if I had the stomach to go through that again. And I also felt like I was like, I think we need a new theme in general. You know, I had a different idea, you know, but then when we got to Sicily, there were all these Testa d'Amore heads, and like, and the Testa d'Amore is about sexual jealousy and adultery. And I just was like, well, maybe that's where we start this. You know, that there's still this unfettered machismo that you kind of associate with Sicily, and like this kind of, you know, this like old world way of dealing with, you know, like issues, and like this kind of like patriarchal, like street, you know, way of handling conflict. And like, and so
it's less,
like,
it's less woke than quote unquote than America.
Certainly
in the imagination.
And also it's just like, for some it's like a nightmare, and for some it's like a sort of bucolic fantasy of how like men could be, still be men, and you know.
Sure.
And so it just felt like, I was like, well, this is kind of funny to have. And then I had this idea of like, three generations of like American men, you know, in different stages of their relationship to being a man. So yeah, I kind of pivoted to that theme.
It just seems like the body would naturally stop getting horny once you're past the age of procreation, you know? Like at 50, you would just stop.
50? 50's not that old.
It just seems undignified.
I'm still virile, by the way. I could still impregnate a woman.
Oh. No girl should have to be exposed to an old guy's junk.
It's not like it was ever so beautiful to look at anyway. I mean, it's a penis. It's not a sunset.
the thing that always interests me about sex, and I think is what saturates the show, is this kind of the animal in us, the monkey in the man, you know, and how, as much as we want to be virtuous or dignified or, you know, upstanding individuals, there's this antic force in us that, like, you know, motivates us and pulls the rug out from under us. And without sounding Freudian, I just think that imbues life, you know, in every, you know, actors talk about what's my motivation? And it's like the motivation of sex is always like primary, I think.
Right. I mean, there's nothing more interesting than sex and money, I think.
It turns out that's true.
But, you know, speaking of money, and I know you've spoken about this a little bit, about what it's like, you know, being interested in writing, you know, and making a show about people, about status, right? About status, money, power. So dealing with that, but also being at a point in your life in which you yourself are, you know, quite powerful. And our listeners, you know, can't see. I can see Mike on the Zoom, and his eyes are opening wide, and his smile is, you know, explosive, absolutely explosive. But no, but I just mean, you can admit that you're coming to writing about this like knot of issues, not from the place of like, you know, a kind of aspirant, but yeah, as a person who in some ways has arrived, or maybe one never arrives, you know, maybe that's another thing.
I know. I mean, it's definitely why, you know, sometimes criticism is lobbed just as a person going through the world and being seen in a certain way. My observations or what I'm creating is suspect because, yeah, I have money and I haven't given it all away. I have, you know, I'm not walking okay with the poor. Like my dad always told me that, you know, we were supposed to, if we, you know, like my dad was a minister and was like, you know, he didn't believe rich people should even own houses, you know, and I grew up in a rich community, but we were not rich. And so like, I always was fascinated and kind of repelled by the rich people.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I will always see myself as someone from the outside looking in, whether I'm not that or not. I think it holds true to just my writing in general, which is like, I like to put out the flawed human characters, you know, like, and not try to create idealistic, flattering characterizations of people, but at the same time see that they are human, you know, like, or whatever. I don't know how to do it any other way. So like, it's like, either just don't come to my class or like,
yeah,
whatever.
No, I know. I mean, I think it's honest. I mean, there's a thing I often say to my husband, which is like, the first step is to admit that you're part of the problem.
And the problem is as old as time itself. You know, it's like, it's not like, yeah, this is like a historical reality that like, I will never be pure. You know, it reminds me of like Survivor, which was like, I went on Survivor,
yes,
and like, you see yourself as the underdog of the story, and everyone does. Like, it doesn't matter. Elon Musk, I'm sure, feels like he's the underdog of the story. Like, he's coming in and he's changing the system, and like, he's, you know, finding all these obstacles, and like, he's going to come in and he's going to be the fighter. And then it's like, so it's like, and everyone feels that way. So I feel that way. I feel like I'm like this weirdo kid who like never like fit in. I was like this weird writer. Like, and it's like, and then I get on Survivor, which I've always been like, oh, that'd be so cool to play. And I've always identified with the underdog. I've always fought, you know, wanted the underdog to win. I just naturally associate with the underdog and gravitate to those stories. And then you get on there and they're like, oh, you're a Goliath. And I was like, I'm the Goliath? What? And then you're like, oh, yeah, I am the Goliath. And not only am I a Goliath, but I am the heel. I'm the villain in this story. Like, there's like, I look across and I see all of these, Davids. And I'm like, oh, this is a story about them overcoming me. And I'm the bad guy. And it's like, and I see that writ large in my own career, which is like, you know, it was always this, like, you know, whatever, like, is this outsider who was determined to write stories that did not, like, you know, we're not about the beautiful people. We're not about like the, well, it wasn't about sex and da, da, da. It's like, and here I am. And like the biggest success of my career is about writing about like,
yeah, like
hot
beautiful people
on vacation.
Fucking in paradise.
And it's
yeah.
just like, there's a part of me, the 22 year old in me is like, what have I done? At the same time, it's just like, well, this is just this natural, this is the natural like stage of life. Like, I don't know. I'm just going through yeah. this. And it's like, yeah, you can reject me, you know, go ahead. Like, whatever. Never. You know, it's just, I just feel like I'm being true to what I'm seeing around me. I hope that I'm not writing this show for the rest of my career or that I can, you know, expand beyond whatever the ideas right. of this show. But it does right. feel like it's like, if you're taking a snapshot, you know, I am being true to like the things that I'm thinking about right now.
Mike White speaking with staff writer Nomi Fry. Season 2 of White Lotus premiered last week. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botin, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.